We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are very glad to have you listening. In this first hour of the show, we'll be talking about Brazil and perhaps at least a little bit about Brazilian politics. Earlier this month, voters in Brazil went to the polls to select a new president. That turned out to just be round one of what will now be a two-round process because none of the candidates in that October 3rd election got enough votes for an outright win. So there will be a second round. The top two vote-getters will compete once again at the end of this month. And so we'll talk a little bit about that and perhaps also more broadly about Brazil and Brazilian politics. And our guest for the program is Roberto da Mata. He is probably the best-known Brazilian anthropologist in the United States. He is a research productivity fellow of Brazil's National Council of Technological and Scientific Development. He also was for a number of years a professor here in the United States at Notre Dame. He's an emeritus professor at University of Notre Dame, where he taught anthropology from 1987 until 2004. He currently is professor of the Catholic University of Rio, also served as head of the anthropology department at the National Museum at the Federal University of Rio, where he also was a professor there. He was coordinator of the graduate program in social anthropology. He's visiting the campus for a brief time here. His visit is sponsored by the Le Mans Institute. That is a relatively recent entity here at the university that's interested in promoting study of things Brazilian and having an exchange of students and scholars from Brazil and the United States. And so we're pleased that he could be here and spend a little time with us talking about Brazil. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the local number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that one. And we also do have email as well. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. So if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here with the Le Mans Brazilian Studies Center, which are becoming rare and rare in this country.
You know, I was just taking a look at one of your books, the book Carnivals, Rogues, and Heroes. And in the introduction here, you write that the aim of the book, to quote you, is to learn what makes Brazil, Brazil. And what is it about this place, your home, that is distinctive? So I realize that's a big question. I'm sure you could write a very big book. But, you know, just if I asked you that, well, what does make Brazil, Brazil? How do you answer that question?
Actually, the book is a small book.
Well, this is a small book.
The book is a short book, if you compare with the question. It's a very ambitious question.
Quite so.
You know, I wrote the book, you know, when the book was published in 1979, so I was young, you know, as a young scholar. You think you're going to write, you know, something like the Bible, but actually... You know, you realize that when you read this to me, you know, my God. Actually, I have another book, a small book with this title. Now, the answer to the question is that I still think that we never addressed properly the aristocratic side of Brazil, which is there. Mm-hmm. You know, Freud said something in little but brilliant essays, that when we grow up, the child that we had been doesn't disappear. He compares the construction of a new building over an old building. Mm-hmm. When you construct a new building over the ruins of an old building, the old building disappears completely. You can hardly notice because the style can change. Everything changes. But with human beings, as we construct ourselves like societies over history, you know, the old forms, this little boy, the institutional design of the society doesn't disappear. So, and it's bound to come back. And that's a very important point that Freud makes. because it's repressed, but it comes back eventually, and it comes back in a very powerful way, and it's bound to come back. So this book is about that. What I did in the book was to look at Brazil from the point of view of rituals as the main window to look at the country, the main entrance, as I say. And I got into the meaning of carnival, the meaning of religious parades, the meaning of military parades. I talk about something, I think the key article in this book is it's something that we often use in Brazil, which is the very aggressive ritual in impersonal situations when you face especially authorities. Do you know who you're talking to? And it's centered to the book, where I suggest as a theoretical hypothesis that within this question, it is contained the hierarchical side, the aristocratic side of Brazil, despite of the fact that from 1889, Brazil became a republic and obviously adopted as a model the Constitution of the United States of America, which, by the way, comes from the French philosophers who invented this what we call today democracy. It was the first experience, was here. And we copied that. And we copied that in a society with slaves, who had slaves up to 1888. So the Brazilian Republic came 1 year after the abolition of slavery, which means that we had an enormous sector of the population, maybe 60% or more, probably more, were made of blacks, detribalized blacks, very different from South Africa, who was probably not speaking their own languages, native languages from Africa, coming from different places of Africa, most the West Coast, but different places of Africa. And they didn't know where to go. They didn't have schools. There was not any preparation for the transformation of those ex-slaves into Brazilian citizens. And this generated a very interesting combination of a society in which the legal codes were egalitarian, because after all it was a republic, with a sort of internal deep perspective that was aristocratic, because Brazil had kings, Brazil had emperors, the whole 19th century. It's almost a century of a behavior, or a style of life based on a very neat, clear-cut distinction between people that were aristocrats, usually whites or mulattoes, and blacks and whites that were very poor, or they were not as dignified as the ruling elites. They're all barons and so on and so forth. And it was a highly stable society because, as we say, and this is what I say, that is one of the components of the Brazilian ethos. Everybody knows very well its place. To be educated in Brazil doesn't mean like to be educated in the United States is somebody that is hard, is somebody who is able to ask a question, to confront you in a very obviously educated, a very cordial way, but confrontation is part of the game here. Mm-hmm. And respect for other people's opinions are part of the game, which is not in Brazil. You know, so we have a very complicated and a very difficult relationships with rules. And after this book, I did several other books dealing with more or less with different topics, but approaching those different topics with the same kind of what I call the Brazilian dilemma, you know, inspired by Myrdal's book on the America dilemma, race relationships in the United States, either going to embrace, you know, egalitarianism all the way, or how you're going to do that, if you're going to do that with provisions like, you know, this country used to do before the great revolution of the civil rights in the 60s. And or in the case of Brazil was, are we going to continue to be hierarchical and talk about family names and becoming the state being an instrument for making people aristocrats, because this is what's happening today in Brazil. You know, the state pays these huge salaries for people that become presidents, senators, representatives of whatever, of the people, as they're called, and especially people that are appointed by the president, who is able to appoint it something like more than 50,000, you know, positions and agencies that are created in which people make a lot of money and become aristocrats. And if a policeman tries to give them a fine, they say to those guys, do you know who you're talking to? So this is the basis of, you know, this is more or less what I try to do in my work, not only this book, because now it's a work of a relative old scholar, you know. But there has been, I've been working through those paradoxes and questions over at least 40 years now.
Well, let me ask you this, because today in Brazil, I think that it would be correct to say one of the most admired and popular individuals is the president, Mr. Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who is not an aristocrat. And in fact, it may be that the reason for much of the popularity and support for him is the fact that he is not an aristocrat, a man who if anybody worked his way up, pulled himself up by the proverbial bootstraps, was not born to wealth, came to the big city, worked hard in heavy industry, became, and as people know, you know, became involved in labor organizing, and ran a number of times for president before he finally won, was elected president twice, and now he's got to sit out because it's term limited. He could come back in another 4 years, I guess, if he really wanted to. And I think there are a lot of people in Brazil that would feel like if he could have run again, he would have, and he probably would be reelected. I mean, how does his story fit into this larger picture about class in Brazil?
Very simple. He became an aristocrat. He wasn't. But it's very easy when you are in power. It happens also here. You know, to be become stupid. You're very clever when you're a candidate. Once you're a president, you are this stupid, you know, guy who does all wrong, all everything that he said he wouldn't do, he does it. So he became an aristocrat. It's a very simple. That's a very simple question to answer. He is in. He was. He lives in a palace, and immediately he learned how nice it is to be there. He cannot be reelected, and it's. I think his government is extremely important. I think Lula's government, it's probably the most important episode in the Brazilian Republic system. Why? Because finally the left came into power. And there is this demystification of the left, which if you don't do that, you know, you still carry on running the risk of becoming an Ecuador, running the risk of becoming a Bolivia, running the risk of becoming, worse still, a Venezuela. And once the left is in power, you have this incredible shift of perspectives. Instead of being angry at the government, now they are the government. And it's very hard to be angry at yourself in the same degree. It's much more rational, and it's much more common to be more condescending with yourself. And this is exactly what happened to Lula. Now, what he did... He did a coalition of government. He brought back the old political bosses from the Nordeste that Cardoso's government had been marginalized because he's doing a government of, as they call, coalition, which the PT, as a political party, which had my deep sympathies, said he will never do it. Here we are, an ideological party. From an ideological party, they became an extremely populistic, personalistic, and dealing, you know, a party that deals with everybody. And he has a fantastic capacity. He's a very bright man. He's not educated. He didn't want to educate himself either because the other day he gave an interview, which for me is unforgivable, in a country like Brazil, saying that when he reads newspapers, he gets a stomach ache. You know, he gets nausea. He's nauseated by newspapers. He never read books. He tells this. He's very proud to be a president, very much like George Bush, who was, I believe, a C student or D student at, Princeton?
Yale.
One of those Ivy League stuff. So it makes me feel, you know, a little sorry in one hand, a little angry in the other hand, and what happened to those guys is that they live in a palace. They have 60 servants. There was some discussion in Brazil at the beginning of his term of how much he and his wife were spending using credit cards from the palace. It was a big, big issue. Immediately, Dilma Rousseff, who is now the candidate running for president against Mr. José Serra, she immediately came up with the expenditures of Fernando Henrique and Dona Ruth, which they, you know, she tried to do something like, well, they spend more money, but they didn't. You know, they're very careful about that. And the whole issue was buried. It was one interesting episodes in Lula government. And the other question is that because of his popularity, he mistook his popularity, and he believed that his incredible popularity, which is obviously he deserves it, because he took many instances of Cardoso's regime and he made it he routinized some of those measures. There is no inflation in Brazil. He was extremely able to take advantage of the world economic growth that happened before the crisis. Brazil went very well through the crisis. There's some negative aspects there, but I'm not going to mention the negative aspect. I'm going to mention only the positive points. So he made, there is a lot of convergence between Fernando Henrique Cardoso's policies, especially in the economic area, and Lula's government. There is more probably common denominators than oppositions. Now, the rest is the capacity of this man to be a brilliant communicator, precisely because he represents, he dramatized within his person the Brazilian enormous guilt that never took care of poor people. It has to do with everything I said before, all this aristocratic stuff. Now, the popularity is immense, and he mistook the popularity as a crowd. He took the popularity as if the popularity is saying, you can do whatever you want. 3 weeks ago, he was convinced, absolutely convinced, that they will make the elections in the first round and elected Mrs. Rousseff, you know, without any question, with a large margin of difference. And he declared, he gave two interviews. They were disastrous. One, he said that he is public opinion. I am public. Like, you know, King Louis XIV. I am the state.
Yes.
He said, well, you know, I am public opinion. The second one was even more disastrous. You know, he said something like, newspapers in Brazil are owned by six families. To own a newspaper doesn't mean that you control the opinions of the people who write in the newspaper. Now, I never received any letter, telephone call from the Marinho family or from the Mesquita family. They are the owners of the newspapers that I write every week to tell me, you know, what to do. And I don't think that any of them call the reporters, the editors, to tell them what to do. So there is a large ignorance about how the media functions in a modern capitalist system with competition between newspapers. And this, I think, is responsible. And the angry. He was very angry when he said so. And this revealed something that has to do with something that I always suspect, you know, this is Stalinistic dimension that you have with the left, unfortunately, which is to have a long-term, you know, project. 30 years government of PT. He will come back. Dilma now, a woman, you know, will stay for 4 years and then stay maybe, I don't think, or in his mind, I think, she'll never rerun for presidency, despite the fact that she can, legally, it's possible. And then I will come back. And then we're going to have PT until the rest, to the end of the, to doomsday, we're going to have a PT government. Yeah. I think this is, to me, from my point of view, this is very clear. You know, it's something that is there. And what is going on now is that they lost the first round. There was no winning. There is a big change, and maybe it's quite possible that Mrs. Rousseff, Miss Rousseff, will lost, who lose the election.
Just, well, let me just for people who weren't following this, that just to make sure that they get the picture here. At the on the third, there was the presidential election. The requirement is for a clear winner, one would have to get over half, more than 50%. She, Dilma Rousseff, who had been the chief of staff to the president,
yes,
and also I believe that she had another position in the cabinet too. It was like in charge of mining and natural resources, something like that. She was the one who got the most votes, but she didn't get enough to win outright. And the reason that I think some people, as you suggest, were maybe a little bit surprised is that she was the one who was anointed by Lula.
Perfect.
He said, you know, so it was very clear that who he was supporting, and for because he is so popular, and because he said he gave her his endorsement, that it was widely expected that she would win, no question. So there, that does say something that she couldn't get over that 50% mark. And so, isn't it not the case? It seems, at least in what I read, that most people think now in the runoff, it'll be the top two people,
yes,
running, José Serra and Ms. Rousseff. And I guess everything I read says, well, people think, well, certainly now she will win. It sounds as if in your mind there might actually be some doubt about whether she can win or not.
I think this is an interrogation mark. Yesterday I looked at my computer and the difference is 47 to 41, I guess. Percent.
Yeah, something like that.
For a person who had 90% and Lula has 80% of approval, and who was absolutely sure that there'll be, it was easy. You know, she was presented as a mother of Brazil. She was going to take care of people. So all this language, feministic language that I explicitly deal in my book, which has to do with this old aristocratic stuff that I said, my God, I'm 74 years old. And I'm going to die with this? I hope not. I think this was over. I think that Cardoso had, you know, just passed this page. We are in a different chapter now. We are not. Mm. This guy's bringing back all this stuff. You know, it's a populist, old-style populist. Speaking of the metaphors he uses, some of those metaphors are incredible, absolutely impossible to be used here in this country without being obviously shut down by several journalists and pundits. But anyhow, that's the face of Brazil that is coming back. As I said, Freud, you know, parable, the child, or if you wish, this dimension that Brazilians never discussed. The Brazilian elite never took it seriously. The middle class of Brazil behave like aristocrats. And you know how they want to change? They want to call the state to change the country for them. And this is impossible because the state is simply another dimension of Brazilian society. The state is you, the state is me, the state is my brother, the state is my uncle, the state is my wife, my relatives. And when they go there, they will do things for me. And one reason why I made that explains Mrs. Rousseff's defeat was the scandal of the woman that he got for her, to substitute her as a secretary for the presidency, who appointed all her sons, cousins, in deals. There are millionaire deals because here in the United States, I was reading today, U.S. Today, the newspaper, here you arrest a guy when he steals $50,000. There, it's something like $3 million, all those little business that they make. And this is has been permeating the PT government, unfortunately. It's a big disappointment for me. It's a big disappointment for people that have been even affiliated. I was never affiliated to any religion, any church, any political party. The only affiliation I have is with books and with my mind, you know, and ideas. But for those guys, I was disappointed. They are deeply disappointed. So this is where we are now. We have now an election that is like an American college football game, you know, Notre Dame versus Michigan. It's hard. The two teams are good, but there's one thing that is growing, you know. There is a reversal of fortune. There is something there which it's very hard to explain from let's say, using our usual journalistic marketing tools. You know, one friend of mine who works in the political electoral market, he advises politicians. He said Dilma is going to win massively on the first round, on the first round, and you're going to pay me. You want to bet? Said yes. You're going to pay me 2 bottles of Johnnie Walker Blue Scotch whiskey, and he's going to do that for me now. God. And if you know, finally, if there is I think it's very difficult, but if Sarah wins at the end, you know, I think I'm going to double the bet.
Let me just very quickly reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Brazilian anthropologist Roberto da Mata. He is here spending a little time on the campus. His visit is sponsored by the Laman Institute for Brazilian Studies. He currently is a professor at the Catholic University of Rio de Janeiro. He is professor emeritus at University of Notre Dame, where he taught anthropology for a number of years. He's also a research productivity fellow of Brazil's National Council of Technological and Scientific Development, and also served as head of the anthropology department at the National Museum at Federal University of Rio, where he also was coordinator of the graduate program in social anthropology, and has written a lot about anthropology. He also writes about politics and other things for a couple of Brazilian papers. And we're here, have been talking a little bit about the Brazilian election, Brazilian politics, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you know, given the fact that here Ms. Rousseff, she is the candidate of the current ruling party, of the president's party, endorsed by the president, but the man who came in second here, José Serra, he is the candidate of the party of the previous administration, of the Cardoso administration. So, and given what you say is that in spite of a lot of things that that Lula has said and done, I think you say, and a lot of other people would say, is that the groundwork for the development of Brazil that we have seen really was laid down during the Cardoso administration. Yes. And in fact, what Lula has done is he has carried forward a lot of the policies of the previous administration. So given that, what exactly would be the difference between Rousseff being president and Serra being president?
The difference has been already we can perceive already during Lula's government these 8 last years, mm-hmm. some differences. One was the virtually destruction of the regulatory agencies, which are fundamental to have a modern capitalist system. The attempt to interfere with the central bank, the interference with the regulatory agencies for the air, you know, the companies,
like, yeah. mm-hmm.
the companies, yeah. the air companies, because it's a big industry in Brazil, everybody's flying. Now we have a duopoly, you know, now we have two companies that dominated the market, and this was done in Lula's government by his aides. One was José Dirceu, where, by the way, he was occupying Mrs. Rousseff's position, and now he's accused of being the head of a band, a gangster, you know, of 40 guys were with him buying votes and so on, the so-called Mensalão scandal. He's under fire. He's going to be judged in a couple of days or whatever, because in Brazil you can always postpone this. But he's running away. He doesn't appear in public. He was what Lula used to call, this is my team captain, you know. And they changed that. They also changed the law of fiscal responsibility, which is absolutely fundamental to have an economy in order. They are trying to restate, and Rousseff talks about that all the time with the PT, of the role of state as the major component for development, which I don't believe it's true, especially in Brazil. As I said to you before, for me, the implicit role of the state is to make people rich, to enrich people with my money, with the taxes that I pay, and I'm going to fight against that up to the very last day of my life, like a good old Republican American will do it, you know, or a good Jefferson, good Thomas Jefferson will do it. All those guys did it, and that's why this country is holding. Now, you can say to me that capitalism is in crisis and so on and so forth. Yes, everything is in crisis, but I still think that one should be more sincere and honest with the things. So they try to change. And what I'm afraid is that with Rousseff elected, we're going to have a new wave of statization in Brazil, and we're going to be very much like Venezuela and Peru, and this in Brazil is a disaster. Why? Because Brazil is a continent. Brazil is not a small country. Brazil is big and speaks only one language. You know, it's a very rare case in the world. It's different from India and from China because there is no minorities in Brazil. We never had segregation in Brazil. Prejudice, a lot. Like, you know, everywhere in the world, a lot of prejudice. But we never had segregation. So he is a country with a cultural potential to really leap and become a world player of first order if, you know, we still carry on with following some principles of economic principles, especially in the financial area, and not let politicians dominate the economic scene. In other words, not to let the economy be encompassed by politics, which was the case before Cardoso's regime.
Certainly, one of the things that President Lula, Inácio Lula da Silva, said when he came into office was that one of his top priorities was to improve the life of Brazilians who were at the bottom. And I think that a lot of people would say that whatever else he's done that. Can that be said? And is that a good thing that we could say that the living standards of a lot of Brazilians have been raised over the last eight years?
Of course. That's one of the positive things that he did. And this is a program that, by the way, was invented in Cardoso's government. That he just made it wide and gave more money. Now, the point is, as we all know, it's very easy to get programs like that. It's very hard to get people out of it. How you take people out of it? By an educational system, which he didn't touch. He created five universities. What you have to create in Brazil is 5,000 high schools and elementary schools. He never touched that. And why he never touched that? How can he touch that? A guy who hates books. A guy who never took the opportunities to continue his education is very different from Marina da Silva, who was also born in a very poor family in the Amazon and has a degree. Serra is the son of a guy who used to sell fruits in São Paulo with a little cart that he used to carry himself. An immigrant, Italian, poor. Serra has a PhD in economics from Princeton. I think those differences should be said, you know. One has to realize that. Unfortunately, there is no saints in this world. And try to see Lula as a saint, you know, it's to make a big mistake. He is a human being. He did very interesting things in Brazil. But Fernando Henrique's government permeates, it's immanent to Lula's government. They never did anything significantly different from Cardoso. They have plans, however, to do it different, and he would be doing different if Rousseff was able to win massively in this first round. Fortunately, from my point of view, and I'm entitled to express my point of view, right?
Sure.
I'm in Illinois. This is the US of A. I can do that in Brazil, too. I think that was very fortunate for Brazil.
Yeah. One reason that Ms. Rousseff did not win was that another of the candidates you mentioned, Marina Silva, who was the candidate of the Green Party, like a lot of people said that she took votes away from Dilma Rousseff. This was probably very significant in a number of ways, maybe significant because she was a woman, significant because it was a great success for a third party. How much of a power in Brazilian politics are Greens?
Well, I think I wrote about that last week. You know, it was published. Yesterday. I think that one of the reasons that she had that because she did much better than the Green Party. You know, she made a story out of it. You know, you have ideas. Ideas are important, but you have to make those ideas translatable to meaningful, to daily lives of common folks. And she did that. And her persona, it's very much like Lula in many ways because she has the role, she has the the physical type appropriate for the role she's playing. She's very fragile. She speaks very well. And she passed on an enormous degree of sincerity as she's addressing to the people. Why? The reasons why she had incredible amount of votes, which, you know, was responsible for the second round in the Brazilian presidential elections, is because many people didn't want to vote for Dilma. And many people were very disappointed with Serra's campaign, which was a very bad campaign at the beginning, in which he even used Lula's picture. Can you imagine? So now he's doing, I think, the proper campaign. And he's getting more, you know, he's taking votes out of Dilma. And then the other stuff is that there was another candidate. We had the first debates were four people. You know, in Brazil, it's very different from the United States. You don't have those direct questions. You don't have those difficult questions that, you know, say, you are in contradiction here and blah, blah, blah. The journalists are, you know, it's very much a ceremony. It's like a ritual. You know, it's very much highly ritualized. It's almost like a mass, a solid mass. You have this guy who is a journalist, but he takes, you know, envelopes out of boxes in order to be fair. We have a big confusion between being fair and being sincere. You know, we still have to learn. It's a different cultural stuff. And you had four candidates. Now we have two candidates. Now we have direct confrontation between Dilma and Serra. And in this confrontation, I think that Serra is far the revelation of what he knows. He's the governor of São Paulo. They also lost in São Paulo. They're expecting to win in São Paulo. They lost one senatorship in São Paulo. So there is a sort of a redefinition by the voting people, you know, that's not the proper day, but if the constituencies, how you say?
Oh, okay. Well, that I guess that works.
You guys are listening to me. You understand me? you know what I'm trying to say? There is a redefinition, which the people that were specialists in the market, the electoral market, and some observers of political scene, some pundits, could never believe. Well, people, after all, they think when they vote. Even in Brazil, they do that everywhere. So I think there is also the surprise in this second round that people, in some situations, at the very moment that you're going to express your opinion, following your heart, not as much of what you keep hearing. And I think this is very important. If this is true, I think that we are, even if Serra loses, really, we are creating, you know, it's a proof that there is some deep changes in the Brazilian social structure, which pleases me very much. More egalitarianism, more autonomy of individual opinions, more public opinion, more strong public opinion, more honesty, demand from the so-called people and newspapers and media in general, and obviously political parties and politicians.
One thing that has been said, or certainly I've read about Dilma Rousseff, is that she is not particularly charismatic. One would wonder, particularly now if it's less confusing. You only got two people. You have her, you have Mr. Serra. People would maybe in that situation would be more influenced by their personalities, just how they present themselves, and that in a case like that, that he actually would have an advantage.
Yeah, I think he has more administrative experience than she. Mm-hmm. And Lula invented her as a candidate. Lula, you know, in order to make her candidate, he passed like a tractor, you know, over lots of people that were very angry at him. You know, especially the PT, he contradicted the party, you know. He became almost like a party, you know, himself. He was very personalistic with that. You know, I wrote a little piece in the newspaper comparing him to a famous short story by Ben Hatch of a guy who is a ventriloquist in New York, and he was one of the best in the world. And he had a doll called Tommy, And Dilma is Lula's Tommy. And the question is that ventriloquists and their toys and their dolls, or, you know, how we call, you know, the puppets, they have limits, you know, and, and I think Lula forgot that. So when this woman is on the loose now, she's by herself, she doesn't have any ideas about anything. She's very ignorant. I'm not talking about ignorance of numbers and so on, because this is, you know, how easy it is if you have a good memory, if you're young. You know, you learn this. It's just like a student repeating, you know, lectures in order to have an A, you know, have a nice GPA. This is one thing. Another thing is to have wisdom, is to have, you know, to know exactly what to do, what difficulties you're going to face and so on. And Serra was a very good minister of health in Brazil. He broke the patents and he made Brazil medicines in Brazil using the general formulas of the, of, you know, breaking up of the monopoly of the great labs, international labs, Europeans and American labs. He created a lot of, you know, angry reactions from those guys. But he made that for diseases like AIDS and others that are very important, you know, to be at the time and now to be attacked in Brazil. He did that. And he's the governor of the largest state. It's like São Paulo is like a, you know, a foreign country in Brazil.
Did he, just forgive me for interrupting you, but did he win in his own state?
Yes.
So he did.
He did. Right. It was also, and they also expected a defeat there. And PSDB won. Now, the fight is how are you going to carry on with the modernization? I think this is the real issue that Fernando Cardoso started, especially by creating a new currency, which everybody's proud of now. Brazilians are traveling like hell because, you know, to buy here in this country, carrying, if you have a nice, you know, some, whatever, thousands of reais, if you bring here and translate into dollars and so on, it's wonderful because you can buy a lot. Mm-hmm. And this is Cardoso stuff. Why Brazil was able to increase productivity, to sell airplanes. You know, we have a fantastic industry of airplanes to sell. The agri industry in Brazil is extremely one of the best in the world. The meat industry, chicken exportation to China and so on. Because Cardoso took the basic task of putting the economy in order. And this cannot be denied.
We're coming to the point here. We have maybe about 5 minutes talking with Brazilian anthropologist Roberto de Mata. Brazil has the tenth largest economy in the world, and a lot certainly has been written about the fact that we have these big four emerging economies. The acronym is BRIC, B-R-I-C. That stands for Brazil, Russia, India, China. But it seems to me that the amount of news coverage that's received is that certainly a lot is written about Russia for maybe some obvious reasons, and China as well. Of all of those countries, it seems that maybe at least if you look at popular press in the United States, popular media, Brazil is the place that you hear least about of all of those. And I guess I'm wondering what you think about that and whether you think as we go forward that, you know, American media will have more to say about Brazil.
Well, you know, this is something that I... It's a very good question. I'm happy that you asked this question. I think Americans really don't care what's going on, you know, down below the Rio Grande. You know, the idea of Latin America for many, even American. I asked this question once in Washington, in a very interesting meeting at the Smithsonian, because we had dinner in the house of a professor. And after dinner, we are five Latin American scholars, and he asked, "What do you think of America?" You know, it was like a high school question. "What do you guys think of America?" And I was so damn angry that after answering, doing my part, we all did, I said, "Now, you asked the question, I know I'm a guest of your house, but let me ask, what do you guys think of Latin America? What comes to mind when we mention Latin America?" And you know what he told me, most of those guys? Confusion, instability, caudillos. And we really don't know where Bolivia ends and Paraguay begins and what language are they spoken there. I met professors of anthropology in the United States that never heard of the distinction between the world was never heard that the world was divided between Portugal and Spain by a line called the Tordesillas lines. He never heard of this. So there is an enormous ignorance about Latin America and prejudice against Latin Americans. So the media, of course, it's easy to explain. Russia was the enemy of the United States. Right. China was the enemy of the United States. Mm-hmm. Now China is the one who has the credit. You know, you guys, they practically, the Chinese own the United States practically, you know, to speak Brump, you know. So it's a paradox. Mm-hmm. And Russia was the great military enemy. India is less than Brazil because all the Indians, several Indians that are professors, they are the best English writers in the English language today, which is another paradox. So it's quite natural that the press will pay much more attention to those three countries and leave Brazil out because Brazil is this country where, you know, the capital is Buenos Aires. You know, we have all those people dancing all the time. They are spendthrift. They drink too much. I'll never leave my beautiful wife 5 minutes with this guy because he's going to make a pass on her. This is the image. And the image will change, you know, the inertia of cultural, you know, paradox, the cultural paradigms, the inertia of prejudice. It takes a long time to change. And we are members of what it's called, we are Hispanics, you know. When I was teaching at Notre Dame, I looked at my department portfolio in terms of ethnic groups, and I saw that there was one Hispanic guy. And I said, who is this guy? It's me. I was the only one. You know, I'm not Hispanic. I don't speak Spanish. I speak Portuguese.
It's Portuguese. Well, how?
It's a different language. It's a different literature. You know, it's impossible. Right now, it is impossible to engage in this process. It will take a couple of years. And the only way to prove that is by doing what Brazilians is carrying on the right way. You know, nobody knows that I flew from Chicago to Champaign in a Brazilian-made airplane. Americans know that? Of course not. They think this must be Americans because you guys believe that you invented everything, which is something that I think it has to have a little change. Not much, because you did indeed, you know, invented most of modern stuff, but there are some other people inventing things too, you know. So it's a different world.
Yeah. As you say, and I hope maybe a lot of people would know, that people in Brazil speak Portuguese. They do not speak Spanish. And is that a problem, that language difference? For anybody in the United States who is interested in going to Brazil and doing business in Brazil and studying Brazil as far as exchange goes for scholars and so forth?
Well, it is a problem only, you know, if you match that with the degree of ignorance of Brazil and the difficulty that Americans have of speaking any other language, because, you know, this is another American problem which I think you have to face in public education. You guys are monoglots, which is incredible. You know, I have an American credit card, and I use the credit card in Brazil, and every month the card is blocked. And I call those guys, and I say, why did you block my card? Because here you have something supermercado. And I supermercado is supermarket. Yeah. You know, and I told actually some of those guys, I said, problem is that you have an international economy, but the people that work for those companies, multinationals and so on, they don't know anything about the countries in which they operate. And this is a big problem because the British, you know, when they were the, you know, when Britannia ruled the waves a couple of years ago, remember? When Britannia ruled the waves, the Romans, they got to learn some of those Germanic languages. You know, Julius Caesar wrote about the Bello Gallico, so all the experiences with the German tribes, and they did some anthropology, and so I think from our point of view it's no problem. But if you talk to Spaniards especially, they say that there is no literature in Portugal and in Brazil because Cervantes did everything. We're all bound to this kind of stereotyped and proud, you know. Mr. Bloom, who is a professor at a great American university, who dared to write a canon, you know, for literature, for intellectual life, the books that you must read included, as a matter of fact, one Brazilian writer called Machado de Assis, 19th century writer, who is absolutely genius, very much like Henry James, which is also included. But for him, humanity was invented by Shakespeare. So I can grant him that. No problem for me.
We're at the point that we will have to conclude right for the moment. Perhaps at some other time, we'll have a chance to talk again. I promise you, if we have more Brazilian scholars here and we have the opportunity, we'll have them on the program and we'll talk some more about Brazil in the future. We'll try to have some conversation.
I guess you're going to have a next guest from the Lehman Center, a very brilliant Brazilian historian called Carvalho, José Murilo de Carvalho. And I am sure that he's going to give you a much better interview than I did.
Our guest, Roberto de Mata. He's a Brazilian anthropologist. He was head of the anthropology department at the National Museum, Federal University of Rio. He is an emeritus professor at University of Notre Dame here in the United States, where he was professor of anthropology. Currently, he's professor at the Catholic University of Rio. And visiting here for a little bit here on the campus, his visit here sponsored by the Le Mans Institute for Brazilian Studies. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.